Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books Network. I'm Galina Limorenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at the BFL in Switzerland, and will be your host today. Today we'll be talking to Mark Hennig about the new book, So-Called Normal, a memoir of family, depression, and resilience. A vital and triumphant story of perseverance and recovery by one of Canada's foremost advocates for mental health. So-Called Normal is Hennig's memoir about growing up in a broken home and the events that led to that fateful night on the bridge. It is a vivid and personal account of the mental health challenges he experienced in childhood and his subsequent journey towards healing and recovery. Well, Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So how are you? How has your week been?
You know, it's been a busy week. I'm located in Canada, and it's Mental Health Week here. It's Mental Health Month in the United States. Mental Health Awareness Week is coming up later this month in the UK. May is a busy time for mental health, but I'm doing exactly what I love to do.
And can you tell us a bit more about what you do?
Sure. Well, I talk about mental health. I do, I jokingly tell people sometimes that I have no other transferable skills, that I just talk about emotion and how we manage it. I talk about my own experiences with a severe and persistent mental illness as a young person. And ideally, I hope anyway, I give people some tips and tricks for how to manage their own mental health and live more intentionally.
And how are you finding this field? Do you have many friends, advocates as well, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've been doing this now for 20 years, really, and ever since I was a high school student. And I've seen the mental health space evolve a lot over that time. You know, historically, 20 years isn't that long. But in a space like mental health, I've seen incredible movement in how we talk about not only mental health problems and illnesses, but how we talk about positive mental health and self-care, self-love. So that's been heartening to see. I think in some ways, while there's been a lot more celebrity attention and things like that on mental health, I think we're still just scratching the surface, that it's still a very superficial way of thinking about mental health. So that's where I've been turning my focus, I find, in recent years has been toward not necessarily expanding, growing more expansiveness in public awareness of mental health, although I still do that through media as well, but rather growing the depth of awareness and really the level of sophistication in the conversation. I think that's where we need to go next.
And I'm really interested in your perspective on how pandemic has influenced our conversation on these topics.
Well, the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, has certainly brought to the fore many of the things that we were already experiencing anyway. Loneliness, depression, anxiety, stress, certainly addictions and eating disorders. You know, it's like it amplified all of these experiences that we were probably having anyway. And as a result, I think because of the environment in which we've found ourselves through all the mental health awareness work that we've been doing for the last decade, it has really blown up in a very public way, this conversation about mental health. So I think, you know, if this had to happen for whatever reason. I think it's almost good in a way that we're able to have this conversation about mental health now, that people are still struggling as a result of the pandemic very acutely. But fortunately, we're more able to talk about it now than we ever were before. So I only see that continuing as employers and universities and other contexts are having more meaningful conversations about mental health now than they ever have been.
So now, looking at all of this background, your book is really timely, and it's called So-Called Normal, a memoir of family, depression, and resilience. So can you tell us, how did you come to writing it?
Sure. Well, I mean, I had been talking about my story, as I mentioned, since high school. The very first time that I found out, I guess, that I was a mental health advocate, and that's the best way I can do it, it was really quite accidental, was that I wanted to speak openly to my peers in school about my own experiences with attempted suicide, with severe and persistent depression. And I was largely discouraged from doing that, that I was told that you can't talk about suicide. It'll give people the idea to go out and do it as though they have never thought of it before. That's not how it works. I mean, there's helpful and unhelpful ways, certainly, about of talking about suicide. But we know that talking about suicide is one of the most effective ways to prevent it, that we want to know if people are having these ideas. So I went and wrote a letter to my local newspaper. That was the first time I ever wrote anything for public consumption, sharing my own story, really for the very first time. And it had this incredible effect of giving me ownership over my own story. So I wasn't standing on the sidelines of my own life anymore. I got to tell the narrative. And the result of that, you know, I had feared that I would be ostracized and alienated and made even more lonely than I already was, if such a thing were even possible. And the exact opposite happened. People started sharing their stories with me too and opening up about their own vulnerabilities as well. So that's what started, I think, for me, a positive reinforcement loop of every time I would share my story, somebody would share theirs with me and talk about the impact that creating that brave space would have. I was doing that for several years and culminating in some ways to the point of doing a TEDx Toronto talk in 2013, in which I tell the story about the time I tried to jump off of a bridge in my hometown to kill myself, and how a stranger, who I only knew as a stranger in the light brown jacket, reached out and saved my life. Well, when that video went up, it just went viral all over the world. It was seen by millions and millions of people. And that's really when I started doing more public speaking, doing bigger events and audiences. I made the transition from writing for newspapers. I'd been doing newspapers since high school, locally, regionally, nationally. That's when I made the transition to doing more radio and television. After a few years of that just really striking a chord with people, that TED talk, I came upon the opportunity to write the book. And that was important for me because there's only so much you can do in a 16-minute TED talk, right? That it's a certain narrative arc that you necessarily have to leave a lot out. And it was important for me to get a better understanding of everything that led up to that suicide attempt, but then also everything that came after. That so many people think that you see somebody on a stage talking about one of the worst moments of their life, that their life must be great now, you know, or even worse, that their struggles must not have been that bad if they were able to make it out of it. So I really wanted to give people more context around the reality of recovery, which is that it's often messy and you can get through really hard things and survive, and that you can do something with it. So when I had the opportunity to write the book, that's really what I wanted to accomplish. And thankfully, because of my existing relationships with speaking and media, we secured HarperCollins to publish it. The writing process and editing process was much longer than I thought that it was going to be. But fortunately, once we finally got it out, it was very well received. And my whole heart and soul went into it. I really needed to get my whole story out there. So, you know, that was the process of writing the book, and the new edition of it is coming out this summer. So I look forward to a whole new audience finding it.
And millions of people have watched your TED Talk, and countless number of people followed your story throughout. So from perspective of the reader, it's really insightful and gives such a much bigger picture of what's actually going on. So let's delve into some of your story. And where do we find you first?
So I was raised on the east coast of Canada, Nova Scotia, a little island called Cape Breton. The biggest city is about 25,000 people, I think. I lived on the outskirts, though, in a little small town on the outskirts, at the end of a dead-end dirt road, surrounded by 115 acres of woods on almost every side. So the isolation that I felt, I think, in that place still impacts me today. In fact, I still, when I went away to write the book, I went away to a Trappist monastery in the woods because I needed to get in touch with that time of my life. So that's where I grew up. It was a very down-home kind of place. And then I think it was getting out of there that really started to expand my worldview more, having traveled around for university, for undergrad and graduate school, and then settling in Toronto, which is Canada's biggest city. It couldn't have been more different than where I grew up. So, you know, it really helped to give me some perspective about what was considered normal growing up in a small town, which was that it wasn't normal to talk about your emotions, that the trauma that we experienced, the abuse that we experienced, was actually, unfortunately, quite normal for a lot of people. But I think that's actually what stopped people from talking about it in some ways too, that it almost felt like, well, everybody goes through this kind of stuff. You know, life is hard for everybody. What makes you special? And, you know, it was only much later that I realized that things could be different, that I could get away and I didn't have to be as locked into that small mindedness as that I thought that I had to be when I grew up in that small town.
So what were some of the moments in your childhood that you realized that perhaps your normal was not very normal for others, for example? It was a little bit different.
Yeah. You know, it was, I think it was after my father left. And I mean, my parents' marriage was probably over for a lot longer than before my father eventually left. But after he left, we struggled with basically on the brink of poverty for a long time. And my mother was a nurse who would work night shifts and 12-hour shifts, often gone for 14 hours at a time. So we hardly ever saw her. She was often not home when I would get home from school or wake up in the morning. So it was very often my older sister or to a lesser extent, my brother who would raise me. And then it was after my mother met somebody else and we moved in with him that I really started to decline. You know, that major change, ironically, after my father left, it was hard. There was no question, but we were all kind of in it together. It wasn't pathologically hard, I think. But after we moved in with the man I came to know as my stepfather, although he and my mother were never married, that's when I was introduced to this culture of toxic masculinity around me all the time, that it wasn't okay to talk about how I was feeling, that I had to be a man, as he always said. That was one of the most common refrains of my childhood from my stepfather was to be a man, even though I was just a little boy, to suck it up, that boys don't cry. I became conditioned to find my negative or vulnerable emotions to be negative, to be aversive. So that, I think, learning to not express myself was what ended up closing down my mental system in such a way that, of course, it was going to blow up eventually. We have to have release valves to let the steam out of our mind every now and then. That's how we regulate. So it was no wonder in retrospect that I never learned how to regulate in an environment where I don't think the adults really had very, very effective self-regulation skills. And that was what was one of the most interesting things about the book, was looking back at all of my medical records, literally laying it out on the floor and on tables in front of me, and seeing the bigger picture and thinking to myself, why didn't anybody else see this? You know, because normal means being so collapsed into your own little provincial corner of the world, corner of perception, that you don't really see much else outside of that. So I think that's what happened for me. You know, so I'd say those events of losing of my father leaving, he was still in the same hometown, but then the really quite catastrophic change of moving into an environment where I didn't feel safe for many years, I think that underpinned a lot of the struggles that I would then face for the rest of my childhood and teenage years.
So what I learned from your book is that being a teenage boy is really difficult. So I was wondering, how was it being a teenage boy with a mental illness?
Yeah, you know, I think being a teenager, period, is difficult. It's a time of incredible change. It's a time not just of physiological change, but of emotional and psychological change as well. So, you know, I think for me, for all teenagers, for all young people, for all everybody, but especially teenagers, what other people think of you is of incredible importance. You know, you just want to fit in. You just want to be seen as part of the group. You don't want to be alone or ostracized or treated as different. So for me, hiding what was very clearly, I think for me anyway, a mental illness became absolutely primary. And that as people started to find out that I was struggling, because I started to struggle in a very public way, it turns out you can't just push down all of your feelings forever, that it's going to come out one way or another. And the harder that you push it away, the louder it's going to come out. And that certainly was what happened with me. So then as people started finding out, my peers started finding out about my struggles, it was almost as though the stigma that I was experiencing, the stigma and discrimination, was worse than the symptoms of my illness. I felt like I didn't fit anywhere, and that's all that I really, really wanted. So it was exacerbating my condition even further. I think that was part of what was most difficult for me. The other side of it is that adults don't, even though adults were once kids too and know how it felt, pretty readily, I think, forget what it felt like to be young and to have nobody take you seriously, just to be seen as going through a phase, or that you don't understand, or whatever. And what I needed most was people to validate my experience, even though I was a young person. And I didn't feel like many people really did that. It felt like a lot of people didn't really see me for who I really was. And it wasn't until actually much later, when a stranger saved my life, that I felt like somebody actually really, really saw me for the first time.
So as you speak of these relationships that are really important between you and your peers, and you also talk about the times you were hospitalized during this time. So can you tell us, how did those experiences sort of influence you during what you experienced?
Yeah, I was brought to I was first discovered to be suicidal for the first time when I was 12 years old. I think I'd actually been suicidal and certainly depressed for several years before that. But people found out for the first time when I was 12, because I had gone to school, in a story I tell in my TED talk, I had gone to school after a fight with my stepfather that morning, actually, very emotional, very dissociated, actually. I'd started experiencing dissociation as a result of not only the emotional trauma, but also sexual trauma I had experienced when I was a child. And not really even knowing where I was, kind of just having difficulty remembering things. All I could really seem to do was to draw in the margin of my test 10 different ways that I could kill myself. And then my teacher saw that, of course, and referred me down to the guidance counselor, who talked to me about it, who then told me that I had to go to the hospital, which took me by complete surprise, it seemed, interestingly, because the suicidal thoughts and feelings felt normal to me. I mean, I only knew the world through my own mind. I didn't realize that other people didn't think this way, that I only knew myself. So they sent me to the hospital, and I was there for hours and hours and hours in the emergency room. I think like 8 or 9 hours that first time, maybe. And I actually felt better after talking about it. I mean, I had to tell people over and over and over again, repeat how I was feeling so many times, that it really let a lot of that steam out of my mind that I had been accumulating. So I was released that first time and sent back home, but it turns out nothing changes if nothing changes. I didn't learn any coping mechanisms there. I didn't relieve the social pressures and stresses and dysfunction in my family life or increasingly at school with bullying and with my academic struggles that were starting to emerge. Although was feeling better for a short time, decompensated again fairly quickly and got worse again much quickly. And that's really what started a cycle over the next 3 years of going into hospital, getting released in back into the community with very little, sometimes no extra supports, doing okay, coasting for a little while, but then in getting a whole lot worse and going back to hospital even worse than I was the last time, attempting suicide in increasingly dangerous circumstances and plans each time, until eventually 3 years later, I find myself on the edge of this bridge, ready to jump, standing on an inch and a half or so of concrete, because I'd been in and out of hospital so many times that I felt like if all these really smart people can't fix me, maybe it meant I was unfixable. Maybe it meant I was unhelpable. And I didn't want to be a part of a life if this was all there was. And I was convinced at that time that was all there was.
So who were some of the most influential people in your life during that time?
Well, I would say certainly initially that guidance counselor that I was brought to the very first time and then several times after that, he became a very important part of my middle school experience with mental illness. And it wasn't because he had all the answers or knew how to help me necessarily, but what stood out was that he was friendly and warm, and he seemed to always have time for me, which was nice. You know, he was a positive force in my life, even if he didn't have all the knowledge for how to help me. There were a couple of teachers, two in particular, in fact, that were particularly empathetic. And I much actually later found out, I never knew if it was related or not, but it's related in my head, that they both had children of their own with special needs. And I think it takes a very special type of parent to have a kid with special needs. It expands your empathy capacity in a way, I think, that most people don't experience. So those two teachers were particularly I was connected with those two teachers in particular. And then much later, although we only spent a very brief time with each other, when I had climbed up over that railing and that stranger, who I only ever knew as a stranger in the light brown jacket, he talked to me. And then eventually, when I let go of the railing, he grabbed me and he saved my life. And then he disappeared. Even though we were only together for a short amount of time, the powerful impact that that man had on me in that time really changed my entire life. It changed my trajectory, because I lived the rest of my life then wanting to be just like him.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The story on the bridge is really extraordinary, and I'm hoping our readers and listeners will watch that TED Talk and read your book to find out more. So let's talk about the bigger picture now. So you already mentioned what normal was, but can you just expand a little bit? What is this term normal?
you know, normal, I think, is just what we're used to. And I mean, I good or bad or up or down or sideways or backwards, whatever it is, there's no such thing as objective normal. Normal is relative. There's nowhere to stand. That it's just what we know. Normal is a habit. And that's why I call the book so-called normal, because here's the interesting thing about normal is that it's so highly relative and in many ways socially determined. Yet it's one of the, it has this unique characteristic of people who experience it being absolutely convinced that it is right and that it is the only way, and that we have this almost willful resistance to seeing anybody else's normal or seeing the world through other people's eyes. And I really think that's the activity of empathy, is to try to understand, or even if you can't understand, at least make space for other people's normals, that nobody else can experience the world the way that you experience it, because they don't have your brain. They don't have your history. They don't have your connectome. They don't know what you know in the way that you know it. Therefore, they can't possibly see the world according to your normal. So the best thing that we can do then is to try to get our normal, or first of all, to own our normal as it is, that we are everything we've ever experienced. And then to try to get it as close as we can to other people's, if possible, or at least create enough permeability, enough space to allow our normal to change. That our normal, I think, needs to be an organic, breathing, evolving creature. It's just our experience of the world and nothing more, but nothing less.
So in your book, you talk about the mental illness, but you also talk about the physical illnesses. For example, when you were hospitalized with maybe broken bones, and how were those experiences different?
Yeah, when I was quite young in particular, I had a series of seizures as well that seemed to be related to the various medications that I'd been prescribed as a result of my mental health challenges. And I remember that in particular, going into hospital, being up on the top floor of the hospital. They had talked at one point of sending me to a bigger city, to a bigger hospital to help me. I got cards from school and gift baskets, and people came to visit me. But then when I was on the psychiatric ward, it was in the dark cinder block basement of the same hospital. The doors were all locked, of course. There were it was such a stark difference from the caring, compassionate, sunny place, friendly place up on the top floor. And that image always stuck with me, how very few people came to visit me on the psych ward. Most were probably scared or didn't know what to do or were ashamed or whatever, or didn't know if it was appropriate. There were probably lots of reasons. Very few, if any, ever sent cards or gifts or anything like that. And that dichotomy has long stuck with me, that I think we attribute people's mental health struggles to choice, that they choose to be that way, and that it's inconvenient for other people, that it's embarrassing, that it's shameful. So people still, I think, to this day, avoid people who need that kind of critical mental health care. And that's such a shame, because we know that while that should not be the primary mode of recovery or the primary context of recovery, we know that people don't get better from mental health problems and illnesses in hospital necessarily. People get better in the environment in which they got sick, ironically, or at least a similar, healthier environment. You have to learn how to recover in the world. But even still, that kind of environment needs to exist as a part of a well-functioning healthcare system, and it needs to exist in a non-stigmatized, equal way. That mental illnesses and physical illnesses are not the same. Depression is not the same as cancer. You see that said all the time. But they do require parity of esteem. They do require equity, that they need to be treated as potentially as disabling, but also potentially as likely of recovery as any physical illness does. So I think that we need to honor the differences between mental and physical illnesses respectfully, but we also need to ensure that we're guaranteeing parity between the two as well, and we're still not there yet.
So as you transitioned to adulthood, what did you want to do with your life?
after the stranger in the light brown jacket saved my life and I started opening up about my own experiences, it was like I had just struck gold in a way, you know, that people are always talking about finding your purpose as though your purpose is out there waiting for you. And to a degree, I can say that in retrospect about my story, but I didn't know that at the time. That when I started opening up about my story and doing it for a living, really sharing my story to help other people, it was such an iterative process that happened over so many years that I didn't find my passion or my purpose. I built my purpose, that I figured it out as I went and made lots of mistakes along the way. And, you know, when I said at the top, I jokingly say sometimes that this is all I know how to do. It's really all I want to do is mental health and to talk about the brain and the mind and the environments and societies that shape them. I keep doing this work because it's all I want to do. It's all I'm really interested in doing. And it applies in so many different contexts and to so many different subjects and topics. So I consider myself fortunate. I'm incredibly grateful to have experienced even the worst days of my life, because everything that I've ever experienced has become material that has fed into this passion, this purpose that I've built for myself over the years. So I think this is in some ways all I've ever really wanted to do, and I get to do it every day.
And along your journey, in your advocacy efforts, so what kind of hurdles did you come across?
Oh, I mean, there's seemingly unending hurdles when it comes to this kind of work. Particularly early on, stigma was an absolute hurdle to opening up about mental health struggles of any kind, because it just, you know, wasn't that common that we were blazing our own way. There wasn't really any right or wrong way to do it because nobody was really doing it. So that was one of the, and that was a primarily internal hurdle in many ways. But also, as I started doing more and more media were hesitant to report on issues that had anything to do with mental health. They often didn't report on positive stories. They still don't often report on positive stories of hope and recovery. The mantra in media is if it bleeds, it leads. So they'll report on all the negative stuff. That's why a disproportionate number of stories that mention mental health and mental illness reference violence, despite the fact that that's a relatively rare occurrence and that people with mental illnesses are not violent, that it's a very small proportion of the population. But we still don't see that correct balance in media right now. So I think that that's a barrier that people face, an emerging barrier, and I should say an emerged barrier, because it's already out there, is this idea of biological determinism, that if you have a mental illness, your brain is broken, and that it's just genetic, you were born this way, there's nothing you can do about it, is the logical extension of that line of thinking. And that's false. It's not supported by the science, but it is, I think, communicated by a sort of watered-down mental health awareness that's been out there for a few years that has had a good aim. Its aim is to try to build legitimacy by saying that mental illnesses are brain illnesses. Well, of course they have correlations with the brain. Everything has correlations with the brain. You can't have anything that doesn't filter through your brain. That's how the brain works. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's wholly determined by the brain, or even worse, that it can't be changed, because we know the brain changes. So I think that's a persistent barrier right now is against recovery, that I consider myself a radical advocate for recovery, that even people with severe and persistent mental illnesses can and do recover from those experiences, especially if they have the type, amount, and duration of support that they need.
And how would the perfect world look to you?
Well, I mean, I hope that there's never a perfect world, actually, to be honest, because I think we build resilience through our challenges. I mean, I was raised sort of a version of Irish Catholic, which is sort of that life is hard, the world is hard, and there's lots of religions and cultures that I think share that view, and I still believe that, not in a fatalistic sense, but rather in a character building one, that you need difficulty. You need discomfort to learn, that learning is uncomfortable. So perfection is the enemy, in my view, that in fact, we need to learn to embrace the mess and to lean into the discomfort. That's really what recovery and resilience is all about. All that said, how do we get there? Well, we get there in supportive environments. So, you know, if we were to have a more perfect world or a less traumatic world, a less harmful world, we would have the social supports that people need to help them through difficult environments. That so much, just to look at suicide as one example, so much of our municipal and social suicide prevention strategies are basically lining up ambulances at the bottom of the bridge, both metaphorically and literally, when really that's not how you prevent suicide. That's a necessary tiny part of the system. But if you want to prevent suicide, then you need to prevent depression. And if you wanted to prevent depression, then you need to teach kids and even prenatally teach parents how to name and label their emotions, how to manage their emotions. We know that if we move further upstream, if you can deal with intergenerational trauma, if you deal with poverty and unemployment, homelessness, food insecurity, job insecurity, that the social determinants of health determine far more than your genes do with respect to the vast majority of mental health problems and illnesses. So in a better world, I think we recognize the social safety net as an integral, as a critical part of recovering and maintaining people's mental health.
Oh, love it. It's basically taking the blame off the people who are suffering.
Absolutely. I mean, look, your illness is not your fault. That I still maintain that just because it's not a, I don't necessarily maintain the absolute reductionist view that your brain is responsible for all of the aspects of your illness. Your illness is not your fault, but your recovery is your responsibility. That you do have power, you do have self-efficacy, you have agency, and the things that you do, the choices that you make, can indeed help you to recover. So I think that we need to both recognize that and support the choice architecture that goes into making healthy choices. That it's easy enough to say, sure, you can make healthier choices, right? But if you can't afford good food or you can't get to a primary health provider because there's none available, there's none working in your area, or the wait times are so long, or you're a part of a marginalized community that has been historically harmed by certain sectors of society. I think if we don't recognize those things, then we can't build an inclusive system for everybody. So access is a key part, but we also have to recognize that access looks a little bit different for everybody. And if we're going to build effective social systems, then we have to do it inclusively.
And how optimistic are you that as a society, we're actually able to achieve that?
Well, I mean, I'm tragically optimistic anyway, I think. Not romantically so, but I think my default setting now is optimism, and that's a conscious choice. It's more fun. But I do recognize that we're far away from doing that in many places. And that's a shame to me, because the business case for supporting people's mental health is clear, that if you have a happy, healthy population, it's good for the bottom line. So in highly industrialized nations where profit is often the motive, where people, companies and governments are accountable to their shareholders and the bottom line is the most important thing, then mental health should be a primary concern, because that's what helps the bottom line. But unfortunately, that is still very often lost. I think there are good there's good signs, I think, and things occasionally move in the right direction. So just like with our personal mental health, we have to grab on to those positive developments and amplify those positive things while working to change some of the things that work against us as well.
And what discoveries in your research for your book, So-Called Normal, surprised you the most?
I think looking at my history. Well, so there were two things. There was going through my history and being surprised by the sticky nature of memory, how I would grab a thread of a memory that I thought I knew about, and then a whole bunch of other stuff would come out with it. And suddenly I'm down this rabbit hole of all these associations in my mind that I didn't even know were in there. And it surprised me that there could be so much in my head that I was completely unaware of, that how did this stuff get in here? Oh, that's how it got in there. You know, so figuring that out, discovering myself was an important realization through the writing process. Realizing how much of my trauma and difficulty was just under my skin for so long. Like it had become normal is just what you get used to. And I was used to always being on edge of always getting uncomfortable near authoritative male figures, feeling it in my body whenever they were around. I thought it was normal to always react strongly in certain ways, especially to perceived abandonment or perceived social difficulties. It was only through writing the book, and I was actually able to process a lot of the underlying stuff, almost in a psychoanalytic sense in some ways, that I was able to realize that, oh, I don't have to carry this stuff around with me under my skin, just waiting to come out all the time. That I can take it out, I can work on it, I can put it back into myself in better order, and then go on with my life and stop thinking about it, stop carrying those wounds with me everywhere I go. That for me was not only a surprise, it was revolutionary. It was healing that this book was therapeutic for me in so many ways.
And towards the end of the book, we find out the really crucial detail about your life, that you had a cat. what was he like, and what was his name?
So, you know, I've always had pets around my house, and a cat in particular. I tell a story in my book that I got when I was in high school and brought him away with me. It was kind of a scrappy thing when I first got him, because one of the first realizations that I could do something outside of my little hometown and that there was a bigger world out there was that I had lived in Quebec on a language exchange, learning French for the entire summer near the end of secondary school. And when I came back, I brought this cat back with me that I bought unknown to my parents. And my stepfather, who I was still living with at the time, tried to kick him out a bunch of times, but he kept coming back. And I moved out in high school at one point as well and brought the cat with me. And then when I went away to undergrad, the first in my family to actually leave, I remember my sister telling me when I was applying, you don't think you'll actually get out of this place, will you? You know, nobody gets out of this place. But I was accepted and I went away. I brought the cat with me. Then I went away to graduate school. I brought the cat with me. I went to settle down in Toronto after grad school, working in mental health, brought the cat with me there too. So he was just kind of always... He was an important, I think, symbol for me in many ways of the thread connecting my childhood and my adolescence, my early adulthood into my professional life and my adulthood. Because I think so often when we grow up, if we grow up, we lose contact with our childhood self, that we think that as soon as we turn 18 or 21 or whatever age it is, that suddenly we're a different person. When, of course, all us adults are just grown-up kids after all, and we are now everything, we're now the result of everything that we've ever been, everything that we've ever felt or thought or experienced. It has all impacted us in some way or another. So I think that cat for me was an important thread that wouldn't let me let go of the fact that I needed to make peace with my past.
Cats, they can do everything, can they?
Well, when they want to.
Which doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a truly fascinating and really insightful discussion. So can you tell us what's next for you?
So my next project, I'm currently outlining and actually starting well into drafting a new book, where I want to try to unpack the biopsychosocial nature of how we learn how to be depressed, because, you know, our brain, certainly through the learning mechanisms of the brain, adapts to depression. I think our mind learns how to be depressed in terms of getting caught in cycles of unhelpful thinking patterns. And our society learns how to not only keep us depressed, but to how we impact as people with depression, we impact our society as well. So I'm interested in looking at the sort of reciprocal feedback loops between those three domains, and then all of that for the purpose of trying to see how we can unlearn depression, if such a thing is possible, or at least relearn anti-depression, I think. So that's the project that I've been working on most recently that's taking up a lot of my time. I also host a video podcast called the Living Well podcast. My old podcast was so-called normal, and the book, of course. But the Living Well podcast, I've been focused on having really incredible conversations with a wide range of people. For example, we have a new episode up today with Dr. Tom Insel, who used to be the head of the National Institute of Mental Health, neuroscientist and psychiatrist, and had a wonderful discussion about his new book and his view of the biopsychosocial nature of mental health and mental illness. So, you know, I continue to do, to follow, to build my passion and my interests in this way. And I'm always excited looking for new ways to do that as well. So living my best life and enjoying every minute of it.
And what would be your message to all our listeners, and especially the ones who may be struggling?
I like to think of the author Anne Lamott's advice for new writers when thinking about this. And she said, you own everything that has happened to you. Why that's important for me is that even if other people were involved in your story, even if other people saw your story differently than you do or experienced your story differently than you do, it doesn't matter, that you own it. And what's empowering about that, I think, is that you can do whatever you want with your story. That everybody has had traumas, everybody has had difficult experiences, everybody's had stuck moments and hills and valleys in their life, but you get to choose what you do with all of those experiences. That for me, it's become material. I can do something good with that stuff that has happened to me. So that's what I hope that other people do as well. I encourage this in my TED Talk, in my book, and in almost all of the work that I do, that what has happened to you, you can use for something good, that you can do good with whatever your story is, that your story is important, that you are important, and that you should never fall into the trap of somebody else's narrative to devalue your experience, because they have their own story and they're on their own journey too. So, you know, stay the course, take heart, and use your story to change the world.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.